There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and just for today urges you to listen quietly. My birthday celebrations have taken their toll. I'm Kevin Day. He's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, what's it like never having a hangover?
Well, by definition, I wouldn't actually know, would I? Because I've never had
fair
one.
Point. That's true, yeah. But knowing in detail what happened the night before must be horrible, Kieran.
I'm absolutely horrible to go on cricket tour with.
Oh, my
because
Lord.
I do take notes.
And use them if necessary. Look, Kieran, it's Newsday, Kieran, but there's a very important question to get through first, which is, have you stopped sulking about line of duty yet?
Yes, I think my initial reaction was, well, that was a bit of a damp squib. And the more I've reflected on it, the more I think it was actually a piece of genius by Jed McGlure and the team, in the sense that it's a bit like the ending of The Sopranos, in that it's mysterious. And also, it was saying that corruption is endemic and it's taking place in full sight and we're not even aware of it. And it's not the Machiavellian evil person in an island hollowed out stroking a black stroking a white cat James Bond type of corruption that exists in society today. So yes, I've done a complete 180 on that.
Okay. Because you were very angry. Corruption is endemic, says man who takes notes during cricket tours and uses them for later purposes. That's probably how Swiss Ramble got to be top of his tree. Same thing. later in this episode, you were angry, Kieran. You nearly ruined my birthday with your anger about line of duty. Later in this episode, we'll be hearing from Amanda Jacks, who's a fans advocate at the Football Supporters Association. And the first news story will definitely be on the agenda, I imagine. Well, I know it was. We've already spoken to her. Tenses get very confused on this show, Kieran, don't they? So, obviously, Kieran, the continuing fallout from the Manchester United fans' protest on Sunday, you've been looking at the numbers behind United's debt, but specifically, can I ask you how much that postponement would have cost Manchester United?
I think in football terms, it's not significant. Clearly, they will now have to recruit stewards for another event. They now have, I think, three matches to play in 5 or 6 days. In the final week of the season, I think it's Tuesday, Thursday, Sunday. So that's going to put extra pressure on things from a playing perspective. But they've already qualified for the Champions League. I think they'll be focusing on the Europa League final. So the costs won't be significant. They'll have to find themselves some buy some new footballs, because in true Mancunian Scally style, some of the youth decided to abscond with a number of footballs, which actually took the number of balls on the premises to below quorate for the match to take place. So they'd have had to got some from Carrington. But other than that, it won't be a significant cost. It's more an embarrassment issue that the Manchester United failed to take suitable precautions for this to take place, because I knew what was going to happen. You know, I speak to people in Manchester. It was open secret. There was going to be quite a few people there. So therefore, they should have reacted accordingly.
Yeah, hats off to them if their plan was to reduce the number of balls to a level where they couldn't actually start the game off. And also, grudging respect to Sky for not noticing that some of the balls, along with other missiles, were heading in the direction of their... Yeah, but it's slightly odd that Sky are suddenly trying to turn themselves into fans, advocates, Kieran. I can't recall Martin Tyler ever saying, here we are at the Amex on 8 o'clock on a Monday evening, it's Brighton, Newcastle, and we're live, and we apologise for making the Newcastle fans having to travel 300 miles on a Monday night, but there you go. And as for Roy Keane, accusing Man United's owners of being arrogant, and then in the same breath saying what Man United have to do is go and get Jack Grealish and Tony Kane.
You're 60, Kevin. You can get away with this now.
Do you know, it's terrible, isn't it? Harry Kane. Tony. Who's Tony Kane? Defeats the whole point of the righteous anger, doesn't it? I can't even remember what I'm being righteously indignant about. But in terms of United's debt, Kieran, what are we looking at the moment? Just to put the demonstration into context. And as you know, and as we'll talk about with Amanda, there's a slightly different context to the United demonstration than there is perhaps to the fans opposed to the rest of the Big Five and their Super League breakaway.
Well, when Manchester United were first acquired by the Glazer family, they borrowed just shy of £700 million in terms of funding in what's referred to as a leverage buyout. And I think what irritates Manchester United fans is that they've effectively had an interest-only mortgage since the acquisition by the Glazers. And it works out that for every £1 of net transfer spend since 2005, Manchester United have spent 80 pence of that in interest. So yeah, it's not a very productive way of dealing with the money. £837 million, however you try to dress it up, and I'm sure the club will try to put a positive spin on this, saying, oh, you know, bankers need sympathy too. You know, they get picked upon at school. It's been justified. Certainly in the early years of the Glazer ownership, when they were paying out over £100 million a year and they were borrowing at credit card rates at up to 14.25%, it was pretty hairy time financially. But they've renegotiated the loans. I don't actually, as an outsider, have an issue with the debt or the servicing of the debt. Now it's the fact that it's a legacy issue, and I know the word legacy is something which we probably frown upon, given that it's been tainted by Florentino Perez. But it's an awful lot of money to go out, and United fans will say, well, we're not delivering on the pitch, and we're having to watch Manchester United from an Old Trafford where the roof leaks, and we're still expected to pay top dollar for that. You know, why isn't money being spent on the infrastructure? Well, it's gone into the pockets of bankers. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, you can't help feeling that the Glazers are now paying the price for years of neglect of the normal fan, because it's been one of the themes of this pod, Kieran, that Manchester United don't really care what their everyday fan, for want of a better word, all they worry about is those fans who are travelling for their one and only game at Old Trafford, who probably won't notice that the roof's leaking, who just want their photographs with the statues, and who just want to spend probably £1,000 in the club shop to take home as souvenirs. They're the fans that the Glazers are worrying about, and the families from Salford and from Manchester who save up and get their names on season ticket lists to get a ticket, who, when they do, as you say, notice that there's a rundown stadium, notice that the infrastructure's falling apart to such an extent that it's no longer on UEFA's list of stadia for European finals, which is a terrible state of events, really. We're talking about Manchester United here. Whatever you feel about them, it's one of the most famous clubs in the world, let alone in England.
Entirely. And it does now seem that there's been simmering resentment for the tenure of the Glazer ownership, but they now seem to be more coordinated. There's talk in Manchester of well, if the Glazers aren't going to listen to us, and clearly they're not, the attitude of Joel Glazer is that he wasn't prepared to sit in on a meeting with the Manchester United Supporters Trust last week. He was approached by a reporter from Sky to say, do you want to apologise to the fans? Anything you want to say? I'm not talking to anybody. Mm. So if the Glazers aren't prepared to acknowledge that they're the problem, let's deal with some people who perhaps do see potentially the Glazers are the problem. So Manchester United fans are now talking, let's boycott Adidas, let's boycott Tag, let's deal with Team Viewer, Manchester United's new front of shirt sponsor, who are paying, you know, the thick end of £50 million a year for the privilege. So what are the United fans doing? And again, hats off to Mancunians, or as my mother used to refer to me when I lived in Manchester for 40 years, as a Manchurian, which was caused great confusion. The first time I went back to my mum's village on the west coast in Mayo with my family, and she told the whole village, my son's lived in Manchester, and he's married a local Manchurian girl. So I turn up, and all the neighbours are looking around, going, what else going on here? But in true Manx style, and Manchester is a truly wonderful city, they've gone on to Trustpilot, and they are giving TeamViewer as many one-star reviews as they can, because they're saying, okay, Manchester United is a fantastic football club, and we've already established, you know, the achievements under Sir Matt and Sir Alex have been absolutely amazing. And anybody that was around in the 60s, but when football was slightly different, you know, best Charlton and so on. Mm. Well, the Glazers are the problem. So this is it, Adidas. This is it, Tag. Get rid of the Glazers, and we won't boycott your products, and we won't give you really rubbish reviews. Remember, there's a billion of us on the planet. Manchester United are more than happy to say that. Well, let's now get the thoughts of a billion angry fans. And if that happens, then it's likely that the sponsors will talk to the club and say, I think we've got a bit of a problem here and it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, interesting, Kieran. I know this is not specifically football finance, so for once I'm actually, I'm not going to say I'm enjoying myself because I love doing the pod, but it's nice for us to get a chance to talk about issues around more general football, as we do indeed with Amanda later on. But it's interesting how the mainstream media, for the first time, really, are giving fans a voice as well. And it was interesting that Andy Mitten was on Match of the Day 2 on Sunday night from the Man United Supporters Trust, I believe, and a well-known Manchester journalist. Sky, of course, are all over fans. 3 years ago, and I don't care what Sky is saying now, 3 years ago, they would have been demanding that the police were called to clear those people off the street to make sure the game kicked off. And now even they've realised that they have to at least pay lip service to what the fans are doing. And that can only be a good thing, to be perfectly honest, can't it?
Yes, yeah. And also, Sky have to work that little bit harder these days for people to renew their subscriptions, because we have reached peak Premier League in terms of viewing figures. The amount of money that Sky have paid for the existing deal is down by 10%, and Sky have got new owners, and perhaps they are having a change of culture. Yeah, we've both been fortunate enough to go to Sky Studios, and the people there are pretty fantastic. So, in my experience, so, you know, perhaps they are thinking, hold on, we've got this big stakeholder group in the shape of the fans. If the football clubs are taking them for granted, well, you know, perhaps we should take a different approach.
I can vouch for the fact that the people who work for Sky, the people who put the TV programmes on, the football people are fantastic. It is without doubt one of the most depressing buildings I've ever been to in the world. And the levels of security that are unnecessary to do a 5-minute interview on a Saturday morning with Jim White. Premier League clubs, have you ever been to Manchuria, brother? I was half hoping that at the end of that Manchurian statement you'd say, of course, I did have a Manchurian girlfriend at the time, but...
No, sadly not. Okay. No, she was from Oldham.
I don't know why that's funny, Kieran. Just the word Oldham is funny to a man of my age. Premier League clubs, Kieran, will be required to sign up to a new owner's charter with, and I quote, significant sanctions for breaches of rules.
Yes. So There's no detail on this. I think this will be, as we speak, being pored over by lawyers from the Premier League. It will be drafts will be distributed to clubs to see whether they want how they want to respond. But the I think the broad issue is that there will be effectively a new rule book, which will have specific issues with regards to open competition, which clearly is a dig at the Super League franchise organisation, about withdrawing from competition, such as the Champions League, from acting in good faith towards all the other members of the Premier League. So it was openly being undertaken by the G6 clubs, the greedy six, that they would have their own separate meetings during or before the Premier League chief executive meetings. They literally go off into a different room and then come back, you know, grinning like Cheshire cats together. And I think this type of behaviour, when you are supposed to be acting on behalf of all members, remember, the Premier League TV deal should have been signed off by now. Why has it not been signed off? It's because the greedy six kept finding excuses to delay and delay. Why were they doing that? Because they were operating on behalf of a different competition to the Champions League. So, you know, Sky and BT and the other senior business partners or broadcasting partners, they pay money to the Premier League because part of the excitement is, are you going to finish in the top four? Now, the old-fashioned fan in us is going, well, it shouldn't be the top four. It should be the championships, but it should be the champions. But let's set that aside. It is the top four these days that everybody gets excited about. That drives viewing figures. If you take that away, then they're selling a different product to the domestic broadcasters, and they were not being honest, these people. And therefore, if they behave in such a way again, they should be subject to sanctions. Now, how those sanctions will manifest themselves, we don't know. Separately, there is an FA inquiry into the behaviour of these six clubs, and we just have to see where we end up. My big fear is that there'll be some type of compromise deal signed, and I'm firmly of the belief that has been proven in football time and time again that self-regulation is not working well, and there must be a better alternative.
The problem is, Kieran, if these significant sanctions are financial, they're not going to hurt the top six clubs, are they?
Well, they're not going to hurt Manchester City or Chelsea to the same extent as the others because they've got a different ownership model. They could still hurt the clubs involved. The FA could make things really awkward as well. So it could be some form of football sanctions, such as similar to what we have for the England rugby union team. If you choose to play your domestic game in a different competition, do so with our best wishes. By the way, the only people who are entitled to play for the England football team are players who are available to play in the Champions League, should their club so qualify. And there you've got a solution. And then it's up to the players to make that decision or to put pressure on the clubs. And to be fair, the players did put pressure on the clubs and so did the managers. And everybody that stood up against this monstrosity has to be applauded.
It's been a good week for Manchester City, Kieran, playing magnificently to beat Paris and Palace. In fact, we amused ourselves during the game on Saturday, Kieran, by imagining a couple of hard-of-hearing Man City squad players thinking they had been told they were going to play against Paris. And then Pep said, no, Palace. You're playing against Palace. Oh, really? Oh. And they were good last night. We're recording this on Wednesday. They were fantastic against Paris Saint-Germain last night and fully deserve to be in the final without a doubt. But on Monday, Kieran, you hinted there was a mysterious legal case by the Premier League against Manchester City. Any more details on that?
Yeah, this is a really strange one. As well as having no life and collecting every set of football accounts that gets published.
Is it like Panini stickers, Kieran? Are you waiting there? Will you do swaps with some? Are you in Swiss Ramble on the phone going, I've got two Sheffield Wednesdays. Can I have you got a Notts County?
I dream of having a conversation with the Swiss. he refuses to talk to us.
Maybe he's just waiting for me to. Maybe he picks up the phone. He sees Kieran Maguire and producer guy and thinks, no, maybe he's just waiting for the day that I phone him. Go, all right, Swiss. You're right, Swiss.
Absolutely. Well, on top of that, I also get a daily list of court cases from a government agency, most of which are, you know, cheeseburger versus Wycliffe or something. You know, it's spectacularly dull.
Or your family. Yeah.
yes. Meghan versus Harry. But on the 20th of April, something came into my inbox and I thought, oh, this seems really interesting. It appeared to be a case actually from Manchester City versus the Premier League and A&Other wasn't detailed. And it was talking about some form of court case which was due to be held in private and nobody was allowed to attend and it wasn't necessarily going to be published and all seemed very intriguing. So I got quite excited about that. And then the following day, it disappeared from the government website. So I don't know whether the judge had said, well, if it's going to be held in private, you know, why are we publicising this very fact? You know, because of Super League and other things, it went off my radar. But there was a report by Nick Harris on Mail Online on Sunday, and also there's been a report by Tariq Panja in the New York Times today, which appears to indicate that the Premier League is still following up issues to do with Manchester City and financial fair play. Now, the Premier League's rules in terms of financial fair play are slightly different to that of UEFA. You're allowed to lose more money. But I think one of the critical things is that under UEFA's rules, there is a statute of limitations in that evidence cannot be more than 5 years old in the case of any charges which are held. And this did form part of Manchester City's defence against UEFA when Manchester City successfully defended the charges. Under the Premier League rules, there appear to be no such statute of limitations. So therefore, evidence which would not have been acceptable to a UEFA investigation is deemed to be valid as far as a Premier League investigation is concerned. Now, there is a lot of pressure coming onto the Premier League from other clubs. You know, Manchester United and Liverpool do not like Manchester City and Chelsea because of the different ownership models, because Manchester City and Chelsea's owners are quite happy just to focus on winning trophies and they're pretty chilled when it comes to making money out of football. So, yeah, and there's also been the fact that these clubs have also been quite hostile to the potential takeover at Newcastle, because could be another owners with open wallets, which goes against the grain of those profit maximizers. So that's where we appear to be. Whether this case has been held, has been judged, we don't know, because it all appears to be somewhat secretive. The two journalists involved are, you know, pretty senior guys, very experienced. Nick Harris was talking about the FFP issues. Tariq Panja, who's got the benefit of being able to work for the New York Times and therefore, you know, is a little, you know, step further away from some of the pressures domestically. He put in a very interesting article today. So that's where we are, where this goes forwards. I think it will progress at a glacial pace, given the amount of time it's taken to get an answer as to whether the Newcastle potential bidders can buy the club.
Sheffield Wednesday players have not been paid again. That's happened so often, it's in a different font every time producer guy cuts and pastes it in. it must be getting so wearing for the players as well, Kieran. But it's, again, April and May, I believe, they weren't paid 2 months, or March and April?
March and April. That does appear to be the case. And it does seem confusing. I think the players have been partly paid. If the stories historically are correct, what the club does is it pays them the first £7,000 per week. And I know there's going to be people listening going, Well, that's okay. Then they don't need anymore.
Yes.
And I'm sure there'll be Sheffield Wednesday fans saying, on the basis of the way that they've played this season, they probably don't deserve any more. But based on my calculations, the average pay for a Sheffield Wednesday player is £17,000 a week. So there are substantial amounts not being going into people's bank accounts. They do have obligations. And also, the club signed these contracts. So to turn around and say, well, we're not going to pay you at all, isn't great. Sheffield Wednesday this weekend, we've spoken before, you know, when we're talking about the Super League issue, relegation can be just as exciting as promotion. You know, this weekend, the Championship, Sheffield Wednesday versus Derby is going to be a fantastic match. It's going to be full of tension, and Rotherham could escape as well. Yeah, so you know, there's a lot taking place. How would you feel if you were a Sheffield Wednesday player who hasn't been paid the full sum for March, hasn't been paid the full sum for April, is out of contract in June and hasn't been offered a new contract? Are you going to give 100%? Because if you get one tackle wrong and do your cruciates in, you've got no work from the start of next football season. You've not been paid. I think it cannot have a positive impact upon the mental state and the preparation of the players, because they've got other commitments. They've got family who will be going, this isn't acceptable. They have their agents chipping away. I do not think this is good preparation for Sheffield Wednesday in their attempts to avoid relegation.
It also sometimes baffles me, Kieran, that football clubs don't seem to realise that they are subject to the same employment rules as everybody else, and it's unlawful not to pay your staff. It's as simple as that. I mean, whatever excuse you come up with, you don't pass problems down to the employees. And again, as you say, many people quite rightly will say, well, if I was getting paid 17 grand a week, I'd be happy with seven, but they wouldn't.
No.
They simply wouldn't, because it's what they're contractually obliged to be paid. It's what they expect to be paid, and they've worked their finances out accordingly. If you know, God forbid, if you send your kids to private school because you're getting £17,000 a week, then that's a problem. It's a first world problem, I know, but as you say, it's something that will weigh on a player, and also, players don't like people taking the piss out of them. That's essentially what's happening here. Kieran, I'm intrigued to know the answer to this next question. As Preston North End are challenging the EFL's decision to secure a funding package worth more than £100 million with the investment arm of American insurance giant MetLife, I would love to know why they are challenging that.
Well, the argument put forward by Preston is that they have acted in a sensible manner historically. They've not overspent too much. They do have a benefactor owner, as do most clubs in the Championship, in the shape of a guy called Trevor Hemmings. But what the EFL has done is that they have borrowed from this American bank called MetLife. They borrowed £117.5 million. And this money, in theory, is being used to pay outstanding employment taxes, which are now due to the government. Preston's concern is, what happens if one of these clubs then defaults on the loan? Because it would appear that the default would have to be paid out of EFL central funds.
Right.
Now, the EFL, we've got £117.5 million loan. The EFL annual TV deal is worth £119 million. So if you've got of these clubs defaulting, who ends up paying? Well, Preston say, we've run a tight ship. We've not recruited players because we couldn't afford to. We didn't want to overspend. Other clubs could potentially, who have not run themselves in such a financially restrained manner, are now taking money from these loans. If they don't repay, then we, Preston, ultimately are going to have to go and pay a share out of this. And, oh, by the way, clubs in League One and League Two, who you don't get a lot of money to begin with, you're on the hook for this as well. So Preston have expressed their dissatisfaction. And I must say, I thought the Premier League was guaranteeing this loan in some way, but perhaps they're not guaranteeing the default issues. So there's five other clubs in the Championship who have not taken the loans. And they apparently are taking the advice of the ultimate lawyer when it comes to football, our very good friend Nick DeMarco. And you know, if there's ever somebody you want on your side in a football dispute, it is Nick. You know, he's got a fantastic track record. I think in the 15 or 20 minute conversation we had with him on the podcast, I think I learned more about law than I have done in the rest of my life. He's a very measured, very knowledgeable individual, and he's acting on behalf of Preston to make sure, well, to try to ensure that they do not suffer financially due to the largesse of others.
I'm intrigued by that, Kieran, because my accountant, Bobby Numbers, always has told me never borrow money to pay tax of any sort, despite the fact that many, many caseworkers at Fleetwood and Sutton HMRC have always said to me, we'll just borrow it. But I've always been told it's not a good idea to borrow money to pay any sort of tax. And yet here they are merrily borrowing money to pay tax.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the sums outstanding were part of the Premier League package. So the Premier League has offered grants of £50 million to clubs in League One and Two. And they offered, I think it was around about £150 million, or it could be a wee bit more, to the EFL clubs in the Championship, in the sense that they said that they would be the loan guarantors, which should allow the EFL to borrow money at a cheaper rate. And I think that the Premier League might have committed to pay some of the interest on those loans. So in terms of your personal taxes, it could be that it works out that you pay a lower punitive interest rate to HMRC in respect of taxes than the interest rate that you would borrow from a commercial bank. But these figures could be reversed on the case of football clubs, because the loan is effectively at a very cheap rate of interest from the Premier League.
Fleetwood and Sutton and I have come to a rapprochement now, Kieran. We muddle through these days. We're on such good terms, we don't do anything formally now. It's like they'll phone up occasionally, say, have you got any money? And I say, I haven't. All right, speak to you at Christmas. This final story, Kieran, saddened me a little bit, I have to say. Leyton Orient have cut ties with their women's team after 6 years, ostensibly to set up their own side, which is a slightly odd issue, isn't it?
Yes. Well, from what I can make out here, that there was a women's team called Kick United.
Yes.
Who at some point either they approached Orient or Leyton Orient, or Leyton Orient approached them, to becoming the Leyton Orient Women's Club. But they were still relatively independent of the club itself. So they wore the club crest and they wore the club shirt. And Leyton Orient have had a think about things, and they are not comfortable about any team, whether that's a women's team or a youth team or a fan section team, who are independent of the club itself and using the club's name. So they therefore have been in contact with the Leyton Orient women's team and have said, you know, as from effectively the end of this season, we're going to have to go our separate ways. We want to set up a women's team. We want to set up a women's academy from about the age of 9 to try to push things through. So the Leyton Orient women's team, or the old one, as it were, I think they were in the fourth tier. They were unhappy with this, and it looks as if somewhere along the line, you know, I've seen press releases from both parties. There has been some breakdown in communication. It's not a blame game here, and it looks as if the Leyton Orient men's team version of the women's team, i.e., the official Leyton Orient women's team, will be starting off next season in the sixth tier. So it does therefore mean that there is a football team that is effectively looking for a name. So it could be that there are some non-league clubs, or it could be that they go back to being Kick United. But they seem to be fairly sore about what's happened. Leyton Orient say, well, you know, we did give you notice. We have been trying to get in contact. We were asking you for a budget, and you didn't set us a budget for the season. And in the end, we got a bit fed up. So trying to get to the bottom of this, I think, is difficult. You know, there are pluses and minuses on both sides. It's just sad at a time when you know, women's football is really on such a rise that there has been a dispute and you know, there are unhappy people at the end of it.
Yeah, also it's slightly odd because Leyton Orient said, "Don't worry, we won't poach players." Which in a way makes it even worse because the women that have been playing for Leyton Orient for 6 years now have got no chance to play for the new official Leyton Orient, if you like. So that wasn't necessarily a good thing. It's odd as well because Leyton Orient are a team we've always spoken about in glowing terms as well. So as you say, it's just sort of slightly upsetting. But I've been an emotional wreck all weekend, to be perfectly honest, Kieran. Anything set me off this weekend? The last 4 weeks, I think we can agree, Kieran, have been turbulent ones for football, but have highlighted the potential for fans' activism like never before. So it seemed like a good time to speak to Amanda Jack, who's a fans' advocate at the Football Supporters Association. And this is an interview that's slightly longer than normal. It could have been twice as long as this, Kieran, because we got so engrossed in it. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us, especially as I'm guessing since around lunchtime on Sunday, your phone has probably been going quite a lot.
It has indeed, Kevin. Yes, I've had quite a few messages from people saying, "I went on the pitch at Old Trafford. Am I going to go to prison?"
Really?
Kind of ilk. Yes.
Oh, really? And it's interesting, isn't it? Because the media response immediately afterwards, I thought, was quite mature in that they were condemning the one or two people who did go too far, but actually very understanding of why the demonstration was taking place in the first place.
Absolutely. And the whole point of a protest is to disrupt. And that aim was achieved. I mean, obviously, Kevin, nobody in their right mind, no reasonable person is going to condone the bottle throwing or, you know, behaviour like that, which is just, you know, totally unnecessary and absolutely not representative of the behaviour of the vast majority of the Man United fans at that protest. But it's always the way, though, isn't it? Whether the protest is about football club owners or education, the university fees, invariably, if there are a handful of isolated incidents in otherwise good behaviour, that is what the media always hone in on. Rather than concentrate on the main point and ultimately a successful protest.
In your experience, Amanda, will there be people looking to make examples of the one or two fans who did misbehave?
I suspect so. Greater Manchester Police have come out very, very strongly already and have said that they are looking for the people involved in violent disorder, which is one of the most serious charges, public order charges that anybody can face. I think there's just one more above that, which is riot. So the fact that they are talking about violent disorder does potentially mean that, yes, there will be some people looking at quite serious charges.
And because Greater Manchester Police have always been very sensitive about football fans, especially foreign football fans walking through the city anyway, haven't they? So they've always been making an effort to try and keep football fans off the streets for the safety of other citizens. It always amazes me that football fans are not considered citizens in these situations.
Don't even get me started on that one, otherwise you'll still be recording in about 7 hours' time.
Oh, sure enough. Good.
Well, but yeah, you're absolutely spot on. And we saw this as well with COVID and lockdown, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, the population as a whole overwhelmingly abided by the rules and regulations, stayed indoors. There was quite a lot of, you know, completely unfounded and evidence-free hysteria around the idea that football fans might turn up at their stadiums. So everyone's going to have to play in neutral grounds or grounds 300 miles away from where they live to stop this happening. And us reading all this, absolutely scratching my head, thinking, where does this come from? And why have we got this sort of parallel or rather tiered system whereby the general public, as I said, you know, are abiding by the regulations, doing what they're told. But there's this school of thought that thinks football fans won't, even though they already are.
It's still a mystery to me, and Kieran will know what I'm about to say. The fact that Michael Gove got away with saying, well, they'll probably behave in the grounds and keep apart, but we can't trust them not to get drunk and hug each other on tubes and buses. It's like, really? I remember I had a massive row with a policeman at Sheffield United once. So I said, any other day of the week, you and I would probably get on really well and then talk about football in the pub. But you're just getting really cross. And he was cross because it was foggy and he didn't think the game should go ahead. And he didn't think it would have gone ahead if we hadn't travelled up there. It's like, mate, we've spent the fortnight. It's taken us hours to get here. We don't particularly want to stand in the ground. But anyway, as you say, let's not. But your instinct will be, I imagine, like all of us, that we'll be seeing more of these demonstrations in weeks to come.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
I think so, yes. I mean, we've seen the Chelsea fans, haven't we, gather outside Stamford Bridge. We've seen Arsenal fans, not so much with Liverpool fans, because even though there were six clubs involved in the Super League, the dynamic at every club and their relationship with their supporters and what the supporters want from their clubs vary slightly. So we didn't really see anything at Anfield because the status quo is all right there. Which doesn't mean the Spirit, frankly, aren't making their own demands, but they are not comparable to the unhappiness that Manchester United fans have got with their club. But if I may, just sort of winding back to the point you made about GMP not being happy with fans on the street in case the public gets scared. GMP have actually improved massively when it comes to policing football matches themselves, but there's this and it's not unique to Manchester, Greater Manchester Police, but I think there's just this inherent nervousness around groups of people and protest, and that is escalated when they are football fans. And there's also the dynamic going on in the country at the moment with protest and this new proposed policing bill that gives the police the power, you know, more powers than they have already to stop protests, to arrest people if they're causing a nuisance or being too noisy. And reading the statement that GMP put out about the protests at Old Trafford was really interesting, because they said, you know, we've had to pull police away from our offices, away from frontline duties to deal with this and get help from neighbouring forces. And I'm reading it, Kevin, and I'm thinking, well, policing a protest is surely part of your frontline duty anyway.
Of course.
And so I think obviously we're here to talk about football, but as an aside, I think there's more to their response than just football. It's all about the politics at the moment around policing, protest and football.
Kieran and I love talking about football, but unfortunately, Amanda, everything else gets in the way. Normally it's finances, but I think most of the people listening to this will have experiences of going to football games and not being happy about the way they've been treated. And you've sort of preempted my first big question, which is a general question. But I wanted to ask you, by using a quote of yours from 2017, which I found while I was researching for my book, and you said, "It's too easy to stereotype and blame fans. There's too little scrutiny of draconian legislation directed at fans, and less scrutiny of how they may be policed and stewarded." So clearly, from what you're saying, you don't think that's changed in the past 4 years, and notwithstanding Sussex Police planting weapons on Palace fans, obviously.
I think we are slightly better than we were. I think there is a bit more interest, and there are some really good individual journalists out there who will ring me up every now and again and say, "Look, I'm writing a column about policing or stewarding. Can you give me a quote?" And I think with regard to the treatment of English fans abroad in Europe, the media are much better at covering that now and far more sympathetic, and actually recognise that there are some countries where the police forces are absolutely brutal and think nothing of, you know, battening innocent people to within, I was going to say within an inch of their lives, but that's a bit of an exaggeration. But they're savage and they're brutal. And whereas a few years ago, the media would just, that their narrative would be, oh, English hooligans abroad, they, not blatantly saying they get what they deserve, but kind of implying that, you know, it must be their fault for the police to have reacted in this way. But now there's a definite recognition that English fans abroad are more often than not more sinned against than sinners.
Mm.
But back to the UK, yes, there's still nowhere near the scrutiny that there should be, in my opinion. We will see as well, you know, with the Euros coming up very soon, I will have money on a lot of local press printing police press releases verbatim about how football banning orders are going to be stopping yobs from going to Europe and hooligans. I mean, the police press releases won't use the terminology yobs and hooligans, but the media headlines, local media headlines, will say that. And that massively frustrates me, and I've written about it loads. You know, Where is the journalist in these journalists who are just reprinting a police press release?
Mm.
Why aren't they looking into football banning orders? Why aren't they actually investigating to see whether they're not, whether they are effective or not? Why aren't they looking into the fact that the vast majority of people with a football banning order have got them for offences that are nothing to do with violence and disorder? Why aren't they looking at how the courts treat football fans? You know, all of those things are just not being covered in the way that they should be. And unfortunately, it's not too different when things go wrong at football matches. You know, thankfully, the instances are rare, but at least once or twice a season, there will be something happen, which ultimately might cause a poor reaction from supporters. But the headline will be, supporters kick off at stewards.
Always, yeah.
But they won't investigate that the supporters are kicking off in at stewards because they are away fans and they turned up late through no fault of their own. And the club was woefully unprepared for 500-600 fans turning up later than expected, tried to search everybody, didn't crowd manage them properly, were rude to them, pushed them around. So then, of course, that situation is going to get slightly volatile. So those instances aren't investigated how they should be, in my view, because the narrative still, even with a disclaimer that we are in a better place, but the narrative is still football fans, hooligans, yobs.
You're doing a really good job at preempting my questions, because my next one was specifically about stewarding, but I just wanted to mention that Brighton incident when Brighton fans blatantly tried to frame Palace fans by photographing weapons that hadn't been taken from them, and I was genuinely surprised that even now, even only a couple of years ago, their narrative was that, well, everybody else other than football fans will believe that they had these weapons on. That's what they relied on. It's only because they were unlucky enough to come up against your organisation and my podcast that put in a Freedom of Information Act, and also that one of the people that they corralled after the game was a Croydon councillor, Tory, Palace fan. And if those three things hadn't come together, the police would have got away with it. It really shocked me that their attitude was still, everybody else will believe that they're wrong, and so let's carry on with that narrative, even when they were confronted with the obvious truth and even when the lower-level policemen were happily admitting that they didn't know anything about this.
I know, and you're absolutely spot on. You know, that there is this complacency, I think, and I'm not going to suggest it's conscious or deliberate, more subconscious, as you said. The assumption was we can say what we like and people will believe it.
Mm. Can I ask you, sorry,
Amanda, you wouldn't find that with any other group in society, I don't think.
Mm. Can I ask this specific question about stewarding? Because it seems increasingly that on a sort of ground level, policemen are more friendly. When Kieran and I were young football fans a long, long time ago, it was the police that you had trouble with. The stewards tended to be volunteers from the clubs and friendly, but increasingly I find that fans are complaining about stewarding more than anything else. For example, just before lockdown, the last away game I was at, there was an issue where stewards got quite hostile to a female fan because she didn't want to be searched by a male steward. And it wasn't handled particularly well, and it escalated quite quickly. So what is the legal status of stewards as to what they're actually allowed to do and not to do? Because I'm assuming most stewards are now contractors, aren't they, from outside the club?
Yes, they are, and that's part of the problem, that they are contractors. And also as well, you know, who would be a steward? The
Fair
pay
point.
Isn't very good, the yeah. conditions aren't very good, and, you know, that there's no escaping from the fact that sometimes they will be dealing with very unpleasant or drunk people. It's a difficult job. Yeah. But it's not, I don't think, unreasonable to say that, you know, a steward's day might start at midday at Crystal Palace. Then his shift will be over there, and then he'll jump on the train and go across to East London and do a shift at the London Stadium. And then when that's over, he might go to the O2 Arena and do a shift there. I think, well, first of all, for many, many years, as we all know, that the police have been inside of our stadiums. Mm. And whilst they still are, they are in far, far, far fewer numbers, if at all, than they used to be. So I think part of the overall stewarding problem is that for many years, clubs have thought, we've got police in our stadiums to back up the stewards. We don't need to invest in the stewards because the police are there. If you add that to the fact that, with some exceptions, I don't think that clubs necessarily, despite all the sort of glossy brochures and the rhetoric, on a match day, I'm not convinced that clubs are seeing supporters as paying customers who deserve and pay for a good experience. Mm. So by that I mean, you know, not a red carpet or a sir or a madam, but just common decency, you know, being spoken to nicely, asked if you, where you come from, you know, are you looking forward to the game? What do you think the score will be? You know, it's football. There are a million and one ways to make small talk around football. All of those things make you feel valued.
Yes. Yeah.
And that in turn, if you feel valued, you will respect the steward. So if that steward then a bit later on asks you to do something, you're far more inclined to do it because you've already formed a relationship with him, albeit a very fleeting one and a temporary one. But you are going to cooperate with him because you've clocked him as a decent bloke.
Mm.
But when you've got people that are there on crap money, who might not like football, who might rely, you know nothing about football fan culture or behaviour or crowd management, they are told to stand on a turnstile and search people.
Mm.
Where is their incentive to interact with you and engage with you? Mm. It's just not going to be there, is it, necessarily?
Mm.
But why is that? Why should you or me or anybody who's listening to this have that experience when they arrive at their football club, particularly as an away fan? You know, it's critical that home fans are treated well, just as critical that away fans are treated well, even if they're only going to be there for 90 minutes and not come back for a year, because ultimately it all boils down to that the dynamic and behaviour and crowd management and forming that relationship where you're going to respond to a steward whose job is to enforce the ground regulations.
I can only talk for Selhurst Park, obviously, but what they do there, which is eminently sensible, is they have the same stewards on the same turnstiles every game. So you do build up a relationship and they do start the conversation by saying, oh, here he comes, here's trouble, or I've heard all the jokes before about being searched. But at least it helps, and it stops them being the focus of tension if there's a massive queue to get in. And there's always a massive queue to get in because the infrastructure at Selhurst Park isn't conducive to modern football. But I'm still, but in, legally, in terms of what they can and can't do, I mean, presumably that the female Palace fan who didn't want to be searched by a male steward was entirely within her rights, wasn't she, I would have thought?
Being searched is a condition of entry.
Oh, okay, right.
So, you know, whether you're a 25-year-old woman, a 4-year-old child, or a 90-year-old man, that is, you know, that is a term and condition that you have agreed to.
Right.
I sympathise with that lady, but you're right. You know, they should have anticipated female supporters, because after all, we do go to football and have done for some time now.
Yeah.
And had, I mean, personally, if it was just like a quick check down my arms, you know, that kind of search, I wouldn't object. But which isn't to say I don't sympathise with a lady who would prefer to be searched by a female steward. Mm. But yeah, of course clubs should have female stewards on hand. And the male stewards should have been a lot more understanding and said, yeah, hang on a minute, love, I'll just go and find one of my female colleagues to search you.
The problem with talking to a proper fans caseworker, Amanda, is I discover I'm not as good a pub advocate as I thought I was when it comes to law around football. What are the main other issues, Amanda, that you get asked about on a daily basis as a caseworker for the Football Supporters Association?
What do we do about fan behaviour?
Hmm.
I think we've all seen, haven't we, there's been a definite increase in concourse behaviour, you know, with fans jumping around and throwing beer everywhere. Mm. And I absolutely love watching the videos of those on YouTube, because it looks amazing and no doubt is amazing to be in the middle of that, but not so amazing if you don't want to be.
Mm.
So, you know, I've had lots of emails from people saying, went to the game at the weekend, took my grandson, couldn't go on the concourse at halftime because there's a load of lads jumping around, throwing beer everywhere. And you know what? I really sympathise with them. Those lads should not be, however good a spectacle it is and however much fun they're having, it's that sort of behaviour that needs to be managed properly. So you are not alienating the supporters that are taking part in it, but you are making them recognise that football isn't just about them.
Mm.
It's about everybody. In fact, I tweet about it every now and then. Well, not so much recently, but before lockdown, I did put out the odd tweet, you know, that said, you know, just be mindful of other supporters on the concourse.
Mm.
Don't throw your beer around, please, because, you know, aside from anything, it could, you know, if the stewards wade in to stop it, then you're going to probably end up getting yourself arrested.
Mm.
And inevitably, I'll get DMs on Twitter telling me that I'm old and football isn't for me and it's culture and I don't know what I'm talking about. And I just laugh because, you know, they're coming from like teenagers in the main. But it's a relatively new thing, isn't it? I don't remember that 20 odd years ago, do you?
I'm too fond of beer to start throwing it around anywhere, to be perfectly honest, Amanda. But it's interesting, though, because that's where I do feel sorry for stewards as well, because especially when you go to away games. And, of course, we all love, you know, there's 3,000 Palace fans at Watford. You love the fact that you're on your feet for 90 minutes, but you can see the stewards talking to each other and say, well, I'm not going to be the one to tell them to sit down. They're not doing any harm. But again, in the concourse at halftime, you can understand why fans would be... Because I know a lot of the Palace fans, and I know that they're boisterous, but they're not trouble. But to a steward, they look like trouble. So you can sometimes sympathise with them, can't you? You're absolutely right. And there isn't enough... respect's not the right word, but there isn't enough awareness of other fans around them. It's not how it was 30, 40 years ago when it was just a dads and lads game. It's for everybody now, football, is how it should be. And you're right, there should be more awareness of what's going on around. Can we just...
But this goes back as well to stewarding and crowd management and training and understanding of how to manage a crowd. And what I would do if I was a safety officer, I'd handpick some stewards that have got brilliant communication skills, probably women, because I think, generally speaking, men... are more respectful of women.
Yeah.
You know, if it's some sort of like, it's a man thing, isn't it? If some like big beefy steward that's 6'4", tall and wide, towering over people saying, "Why you behave today?" That's not going to end well, is it? But if you get a nice, I'm almost reluctant to say this, mumsy type,
no.
You know, the matriarchal figure, are standing at the away turnstiles. We all know who the lads are that are going to be behaving in this way, don't we?
Yes.
She greets them. All right, lads, looking forward to the game, blah, blah, blah. Just to let you know that my safety officer really doesn't like the jumping around throwing a beer. I know you've...
Is he all right?
Neither does your dog by the sounds of it.
Is that Finley, Kieran?
Oh, yeah, yes, on. Yes, Finley has just seen a guy with a skip arriving in our front garden.
Okay. Well, Finley's quite a posh dog, Amanda. Finley wouldn't like a skip arriving in the garden in Sussex.
Would he not?
No, Finley. Finley
sounds very ferocious.
Yeah, Finley's not as ferocious as he sounds, but he doesn't like the attention that we're getting. He likes to get involved in the pod. But your point about women stewards is absolutely right, because in my other world, in theatre and comedy, increasingly it's women that you see on the door of theatres and comedies, because as you say, not only are men more respectful for them, but just women are better at diffusing situations, I find. Whereas men tend to escalate problems sometimes, women are better at spotting trouble and cutting it off, I've always believed.
I think broadly speaking, I mean, there's always exceptions to the rule, aren't there? But I think broadly speaking, you're right. In fact, some of the best stewarding I've ever seen, I was at, because I'm a West Ham supporter, and this is many, many years ago, at Spurs away. And they scored against us, and I can't remember who it was who scored, because I sort of like block things like that out of my memory.
Of course.
But the scorer of the goal came over and sort of like celebrated in front of us away fans. So you can just imagine, can't you, the reaction from the West Ham faithful. A couple of the blokes there decided that they were going to go and rip this player's head off. So started to charge down the steps. This female steward just stepped out of nowhere, didn't even see her. She was about 5'5", and she just stood in the middle of her steps with her arms out. And these three blokes, put on the brakes, stopped in their tracks, told this player exactly what they thought of him over this woman's outstretched arms, then said, sorry about that, love, and went back to their seats.
Yeah,
and it was just absolutely brilliant. But if you would have like sent in the response team, you know, the big burly blokes, that inevitably would have ended badly. Yeah. And this is sort of where I think clubs, they're all about, or not all about, but there's too much about seeing people, fans, and again, particularly away fans, as potential public order problems and not customers.
Yeah, it's...
So I think if safety officers could have a lot to learn from their colleagues in corporate hospitality.
Sorry, Amanda. I'm just conscious of time, as I'm already ditching loads of questions because it's already turned into a long interview, which is brilliant. But it's wonderful how West Ham are doing this season. But my best friend is a West Ham season ticket holder, and I publicly tipped them to be relegated on radio. So I'm not a happy bunny about how well they're doing. I just want to talk to you bring it back to issues around the Super League and what's happening in the future, Amanda. I mean, the last 4 weeks have been incredible in terms of highlighting the power that fans actually have in the game. It's been wonderful. But for me, it's been tempered by a slight frustration that fans seem to have been able to scupper the Super League but just couldn't do anything to save clubs like Bury or Macclesfield. It's brilliant to see what happens when you can get fans mobilised, but it just doesn't always work, does it?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, supporter groups comprise people from all backgrounds, all walks of life. Ultimately, they are volunteers with day jobs, families and everything else. I think it was serendipitous. Can I say that?
Of course you can.
I like that word.
Yeah, I can't.
That the six groups involved in the Super League, the six clubs, all have brilliant supporter groups with brilliant people in them. Clever, talented, intelligent, articulate, organised people. And maybe other clubs elsewhere don't necessarily have that. Or there's local issues, or because, you know, people are people, aren't they, ultimately? And I think there can sometimes be this sort of utopian idea around football that supporters groups can come in and we can do this and we can do that. But very obviously, they're only as good as the people within them. And I'm absolutely not saying groups, clubs elsewhere don't have good groups, but that inevitably that there can be a lot of factors into why they haven't been able to achieve the saving of their club. Mm. Because fans fight within themselves as well.
They do, unfortunately, as we're seeing at Bury as well. And I suppose as well as the lack of media attention as well for, you know, clubs like Bury and Macclesfield aren't sexy like the top six are. But I don't recall in my entire lifetime of supporting football, I don't recall any weekend or any football news story that galvanised as much interest as that. As that Super League story. I mean, it's incredible to watch it unfold as well. And also it's one of those things where the rest of the nation suddenly realise the scope and the width of the amount of people who support football clubs. I always use the example to Kieran of the Pawson's Arms, a tiny pub in Thornton Heath where we drink before Palace games. And yeah, there's a couple of bus drivers and a cab driver, but there's accountants, there's a judge. There's a theatre producer. Football fans come from all walks of life now. And when they come together and pitch those skills in together, as we've seen, it has an amazing effect.
It absolutely does, yes. And I think clubs as well. I mean, sidestepping slightly, one of our aims is to have a supporter on every safety advisory group. And safety advisory group is hosted by a local authority and comprises people from the Sports Ground Safety Authority, the police, St John's Ambulance, the fire service, the highways department, you know, anybody that's involved in the safe running of a football match. And we think and have done for some time now that supporters should be represented on the safety advisory group because, after all, nobody knows supporters better than supporters. Mm. And aside from anything, we can give a very different angle and a unique perspective to things. Mm. We are still hearing, you know, from safety advisory groups around the country, oh, no, we can't have supporters because they won't know how to conduct themselves. Jeez. Or they might breach confidentiality. Which again goes back, Kevin, doesn't it, to what you said at the very start of this, of how football fans are seen as some sort of other,
yes,
this homogenous mass. Yeah. We're not seen as judges and solicitors and accountants and chief executives and doctors and nurses and all of those things, which, you know, each individual profession carries a different and valuable skill set. We're just not seen like that. And it baffles me. Mm.
Talking of representation, Amanda, our government, with their newfound love of football, has announced a fan-led review, which is going to be headed by Tracy Crouch, the sports minister. Have the SFA been involved in setting the parameters for that inquiry, or will they be?
Our chief exec, Kevin Miles, has a very good relationship with Tracy
good.
Crouch.
I know Kevin.
So, yes, I'm sure that he will be working incredibly hard behind the scenes to make sure that everything goes as far as possible our way. Mm. And when I say our, I don't just mean the Football Supporters Association as an organisation. I mean us and all of our members and the supporter groups who are broadly unified on where we should be in terms of regulation and so on.
I'm guessing we won't get a new fan ownership model out of it, but we might get an independent regulator. What's the most you think we can hope for?
That the recommendations are accepted by supporters and implemented, whatever those recommendations might be.
Amanda, it's been brilliant to talk to you. I genuinely could talk to you all day, and there's a lot of things I haven't got around to asking you. But it's been lovely to hear from you. And I think as the fan-led review unfolds, we'll be getting you back and certainly getting people from the FSA back as well. Give my regards to Kevin Miles, who I've known for some time, and to everybody at your organisation, which started, a lot of our listeners as well, I mean, literally started as two men and a dog in a back room, and is now a brilliant organisation.
Thank you.
But also it's slightly unfortunate that we still need it, isn't it? It's slightly unfortunate that even in this day and age we're still talking about the same issues that we've been talking about as football fans for such a long time. I tell my son's 25, and I tell him the way we were treated sometimes back in the late 70s and early 80s, And it's just like, I'm a good Guardian reading liberal, but I firmly believe that sometimes if you keep treating people like animals, they will occasionally behave like them. You know, I always tell them about the special. We got a special to Wrexham once, and it was a normal train, but with a coach added on for us, and we were padlocked in, and there was no toilet. And it's like, my son doesn't believe it, but that's how we were. There were several police forces, West Midlands, South Yorkshire. You just didn't look forward to going to games in those places, because if I went as a tourist to Sheffield on a Thursday or Friday, I'd be treated with the utmost respect. Well, if I go on a Saturday with a Palace scarf on, you're just terrified until you get home, basically. And it's not how it should be. But unfortunately, we still need the Football Supporters Association, and you have the respect and admiration of both Kieran and I. So thank you very much.
That's very kind.
Now, sometimes, Kieran, I worry. If we have a guest whose main focus isn't football finance, if you like, isn't the price of football, I sometimes worry that listeners will be wondering why we're talking to them. But in this occasion, any fears disappeared after 2 or 3 minutes, because it was fascinating what Amanda had to say. And also, you and I have very romantic views of football fans and their place in football culture. But Amanda is somebody who's working with fans every day to settle the everyday arguments that fans all over the country are having with football clubs, and she's doing a remarkable job.
Yeah, she is absolutely amazing. I know one or two people that have been helped by Amanda, and they speak of her in glowing terms. And you're absolutely right, Kevin. It is slightly outside of our normal sphere, but ultimately, I think, you know, we say that this is a football finance show. This is a football finance show for fans, and yeah. I've been on a pitch invasion. I've been stopped and searched by police officers, and these are things that are happening. And if they can happen to a, very 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 dull middle aged teetotal chartered accountant, then they can happen to people who are half my age and perhaps a bit less laid back than me. And these people, and we all need the belief that there'll be somebody standing up for us. And if anybody has ever had any issues in terms of the way that they have been treated at a football match, remember, you're citizens first, and you're football fans second, and you are entitled to the support of the legal form. So FSA Faircop on Twitter. That's Amanda. And she's absolutely brilliant. Anybody that's had any dealings with her will confirm that.
I also like the fact that Amanda's quite happy to admit that some football fans are idiots, basically, which every now and again you and I forget that, Kieran, of our romantic views. Yeah, sometimes they're idiots, because, sometimes they do bounce up and down in crowded concourses throwing beer everywhere. You're right. I also like the fact, Kieran, that you're implying your pitch invasion was accidental.
No, my pitch invasion was absolutely on purpose. April 1996, our ground had been sold. We had nowhere to play. With the people that had sold the ground had changed the constitution for the club, and we got the match called off. And if that makes me part of a mob, then so be it. The fact that I've got a football club to support today, to me, means that the classic case of the means justifies the ends, and so on.
Although there is nothing sadder than the sight I've seen a couple of times with people invading the pitch, looking around expecting to see hundreds of people behind them, and everyone else is just sitting resolutely in the stand still, going, "What's Terry doing?"
Streaking, normally.
You've not done that, Kieran, have you?
No.
All right, I'm still reeling from your admission earlier on, just before we started recording, that it used to be in Hare Krishna.
I was going through a vegetarian phase, and this seemed to sort of take it to one step further. And I'm a lover, not a fighter, Kevin. So I thought this was a way of taking it to another level.
I believe that's still the caption under your wanted poster in Moscow: lover, not fighter. Wanted for loving. If anything, Kieran, that's your only crime, loving too much. Thanks to everyone who's become a patron of our pod via the Patreon site, including Andy Myers, Nick Parkhouse, Ricky Prince and Matt Butland, who says thank you all for such an entertaining and insightful look into the world of football finance, even if it does come from a Brighton fan. Keep up the good work. I'll make this promise now to all patrons that I will be less hungover next time I do this pod. And considering it's 3 days since my birthday party, that's some going. Also, Kanad Akot, I hope I've pronounced that right, Kanad, who says, I'd like to send my support to all fans of the so-called Big Six, especially Man United fans. We foreign United fans completely stand with those protesting that the Glazers around Old Trafford, we hope for change. Again, we should acknowledge, Kieran, the many, many overseas football fans who took exception to us saying that they were part of the problem and that clubs were using them as their excuse for doing all sorts of things. We apologise to all of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And of course, if you have any questions for our next pod, which will be on Monday, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And Kieran, before we go, I hear your audiobook is out. That's a clever pun. I hear your audiobook is out. Any truth to the rumour, Kieran? It was Simon Callow who read it.
Sadly not. it was myself who had to do it. And I went into this recording studio and I met this guy called Paul Cheese, who was the recording engineer. And I said, I've got no idea what I'm doing here. And he says, that's okay. The guy that did the last one, he didn't have a clue either. I said, well, that's okay. Who was he? He said, oh, it's Roger Daltrey. I'm going, right. I think he doesn't have anything to worry about. But yes, the Price of Football book now does have an audio version for anybody who would like to listen to it. And I can't think of any reason why. It's 8 hours and 50 minutes of me talking about amortization.
Yeah. I'll tell you who wants to listen, Kieran. HGV drivers on long journeys. That's who wants to listen. The audiobook, they're amazingly popular. The issue I had when I recorded mine, which is, I don't know how long yours take, mine was 4 days. You talk about first world problems, Kieran. I don't think some of our listeners realise how difficult it is to sit in a studio having tea and cakes brought to you every year. But my sound engineer had no interest in football whatsoever. Never been to a game. Couldn't understand what the fuss was all about. It made the day. He was lovely. He was nice. He was a nice bloke. And I got no interest in Dungeons and Dragons. So there was no meeting in my head. And every now and again, I'd have to look up and say to him, I've finished that chapter now. And he'd put his book down and go, all right, great. But no, I'm glad your book is available. It's a very popular, a lot of people want to listen rather than read, Kieran. But I would like to have been there as you read out some of the facts and figures and tables.
Yes, that was very confusing, even for me.
And on that note, we shall say goodbye. And I promise you, I was straightened myself out by the time we record the next pod and remember the names of the Tottenham strikers.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.